All right, good morning. So let me start reviewing what we have done last lecture, because it's the most important part of the lecture, if you want. It really tells you the basic dictionary there is between, you know, what's happening in the bulk of ADS and what's happening on the boundary with the CFT. And so on the boundary, we have just the standard super young males, you know, except that we have to consider, you know, strong coupling and infinite number of colors and stuff like that. And for that, we have the corresponding partition function, which depends on some source, which I called yesterday J, but now I'm calling it phi zero for the obvious reasons to follow. And of course, this partition function is nothing else than, you know, some kind of path integral where you say, well, I put a source for some operators here. So this is your standard action without the source. I'm doing everything in the Euclidean regime, so that's why there's an E here. But you put this source over here, and so what this thing here really is an expectation value of this exponential of you know, this source term over here. And if you can calculate it, you calculate it, that's what gives you something like the Fourier G, right? And so that's W over here. And so now it's obvious from this prescription that if I start differentiating this W with respect to the source phi, then it brings down the operator O here, and that precisely corresponds to the expectation value of these operators if I do this differentiation. So standard QFT prescription or statistical physics prescription will be just differentiate this W with respect to the source as many times as you want, and that gives you the corresponding correlation function or the expectation value of. Okay, so that's the standard CFT thing. Of course, you don't know typically how to calculate this in the large lambda. You do it for small lambda. You do it, well, anyway. Okay, so here, now the ADS CFT conjecture claims, well, this is exactly equivalent to type 2B superstring on ADS 5 cross S5 with the corresponding source phi 0. And the question is, what is that source for phi 0? And the answer is, well, this is just a boundary value of some classical scale of some classical field, which actually, you know, propagates in your bulk spacetime. Okay? And so this phi 0 you are now identified is the boundary value of a classical field. But of course, you can use, because your supergravity, well, in this limit, you have just really weak supergravity and stuff like that. You take WKB approximation, and you just approximate this by the classical action evaluated on classical solutions over here. And now, if you are looking at this and compare, you know, what you see here with whatever you see there, you see that this magic W, which gives me everything, is simply given by this classical action of supergravity, where your field phi has this boundary value at infinity. Okay, so that's a magic prescription. So basically, you can calculate any correlation functions by doing classical calculations, studying classical fields in the bulk, and just, you know, saying, well, the boundary value of this field is precisely plays the role of the source in this W here. Okay, and so we have this recipe. So first of all, if you want to calculate the expectation value of, you know, of this thing here for some operator, you need to know what kind of bulk field you should be studying in this ADS space. And the guiding principle is the symmetries. So typically, if you have scale operator here, well, then it's obvious that you should be studying scale operator in the bulk, well, scalar field in the bulk. If you have, I don't know, vector operator, you will be studying the gauge field in the bulk and stuff like that. Right, but also, you know, these operators on the CFT side, they are characterized by the scaling dimension delta, and this will be somehow related to the properties of the bulk field. In particular, this will be related to the mass of this bulk field over here. Okay, so you know, if you want to calculate this, you first determine what the bulk field is, and then you have to, you know, this bulk field satisfies some kind of equations which follow from this supergravity. And so you have to solve these equations, of course, subject to the fact that this phi zero is really your boundary value for that field at infinity. And once you have the solution, you can plug it back to your action for the field, And, you know, plugging it back means you evaluate it as a function of this boundary value, phi 0. And that's your Hamilton's function. That's precisely this guy over here. And you can start differentiating happily this guy to get these correlation functions here. Is that clear? So that's the recipe ADS-CFT provides you. And it's super, super nice. So now we had a toy example. So we said, well, OK, let's consider a scalar CFT operator with some primary scale operator. And then they should somehow correspond to a scalar field in the bulk. So let's study the scalar field. Let's do it in d dimensions. Why not? So this is the corresponding action for the massive scalar field. This mass is related to the delta according to this prescription. Okay. And so this thing here will be dual to a scalar primary operator O delta, where we said, well, we will identify this delta. So you have sort of two solutions for which relate delta with the mass, and you take the bigger one. So you take delta equal to delta plus. Typically, if your mass is negative, well, m squared is negative, they can interchange the roles. But this is the standard prescription. Okay, and so that's the part one. We identified what is the corresponding bulk field for our primary operator O delta. The part two is, well, this scalar field will satisfy some equations of motion. Of course, they follow from this action. They are just massive Klein-Gordon equation. It's over here. So that's my equation of motion. And then you can write it down explicitly, and you will do it in your homework. And we can do the Fourier transformation is respect to these x coordinates. So last time I just did plane wave, but in principle, so I just did that. But you can, well, more generally, you have to do this. And then you find the corresponding equation of motion just looks like this. Okay. And then what we also did yesterday is that we looked at it close to the boundary at z equal to 0. And we realized, well, indeed, this phi here has to behave like, you know, the z to delta minus and z to delta plus close to the boundary. And I was trying to argue is that there is some. So of course, this is the boundary value which we are looking for. So that's the source which we need. But there is this other term. And this is also very interesting interpretation, and is the expectation value of this operator of delta plus. OK? So this is what we have done yesterday. So now we are happily proceeding in our recipe. So we already wrote down the equations of motion. We determine their asymptotic behavior. But of course, you know, in order to do this, we really need to solve these equations of motion, right? And so once we have the solution, we plug it back to this action here. And that's what gives us the Hamilton's function, right? So now, really, we need to solve these equations. And so whereas, you know, the asymptotic behavior, you can get really, I take this equation, I consider z is almost 0, so that kills my k squared, z squared term and stuff like that. But really, now you need the full solution. So now the full solution. And so the full solution will be given by Bessel functions. And so it can be written as phi z k, some constant ak, z to power d over 2. And there is one of the Bessel functions, k nu of z k. And the second solution is a second order differential equations. We have two solutions. So the second solution is given by z to d over 2 and some other Bessel function, zk. Okay. So that's the solution. So now typically what happens, so remember, we are using our Poincaré coordinates for our ADS space-time. And so we have two boundaries. So we have the boundary at z equals 0, which is the boundary. And then we have another boundary at z equal to infinity, z goes to infinity, which is the Poincaré horizon. Okay? And so you know from your GR that Poincaré horizon is just a coordinate singularity. So you know at that horizon, things shouldn't blow up, right? There's no curvature singularity. There's nothing. So things shouldn't blow up. But if you look at the solutions and the behavior of K and I, what you find is that the K behaves, I hope this is correct, K nu behaves like this. It sort of goes to zero here when Z is infinity, but it blows up at Z equal to zero, and I goes precisely the opposite way. So you have I nu, and so it blows up on this Poincaré horizon. Okay, and so this is what we don't want, right? Because there shouldn't be any singularity, there shouldn't be any blow up, any disaster on the Poincaré horizon because it's just a coordinate singularity. Okay, so what it means is that we have to kill this function here. Okay, not here. This was good. I knew it's here, but we have to kill it here. So we have to kill this term. So by the way, I didn't tell you what the new is. So new here, of course, there will be something specific here, and it will be determined by the parameters of this equation. It's given by delta minus d over 2, which is d squared over 4 plus m squared L squared. Okay? So this is what that new is. Okay, so our solution, which you know doesn't blow up on the Poincaré horizon, is just given by this k function here. But if you expand this k function close to z equal to zero, what you will find is that so as z goes to zero, we find that k nu behaves like z minus nu. Okay, and nu is this delta minus d over 2. Right? And there is a z to d over 2 here. So it goes like z to d over 2 plus d over 2 minus delta. So this goes like z to d minus delta. And then now we still have this ak over here, right? So what it means is if you compare this thing here. So there was a relation between delta minus and delta plus, right? It said delta plus is our delta, which means that delta minus is
delta minus d.
Something like that, right? Must be d minus delta, probably. Right? So okay, very good. So now if you look at this thing here, so this goes like z to d over 2. That goes like z to minus nu. So now this ak over here, if I compare it to this thing here, must go like phi 0. Okay, so from here, it follows that this ak somehow must be related to phi 0. Okay, and then you can write down the normalized solution. So the normalized solution just was one warning, right? So the k nu blows up at z equal to zero exactly. So in order not for it not to blow up, you introduce a cutoff. You don't go to z equal to zero, but rather you only go to z equal to epsilon. So you cut it over here. So this is z equal to epsilon, and you evaluate it there. And then you want that at that z equal to epsilon, this behaves like phi zero epsilon to delta minus right? So normalized solution will be phi zk equals to, and now I write it in this cunning way, which you can easily justify. D over 2, k nu, epsilon, k, and then phi, 0, k, epsilon, d minus delta. Okay, so that's your solution of the equations of motion, which, first of all, doesn't have any problems on the Poincaré horizon. And second, it reduces to epsilon, to phi 0 k times epsilon d minus delta when z is equal to epsilon. When z is equal to epsilon, this guy cancels that guy. And this is the behavior which we are looking for. OK, so we solve the equations of motion. We have the desired solution. Now, you want to evaluate, so you want to plug this back, take the solution, and plug it back to that action over there. Right? So that's the step number three. That's what gives us the Hamilton's function. So step number three, get Hamilton's function. Okay, so now let's see, right? So this is our action. How do you derive equations of motion from the action? Well, you vary it with respect to the field. And then typically you have to integrate it by parts so that you shift the derivatives from d of delta phi to the other thing. Right? So now, as a result of varying this action, you get bulk equations of motion. So you get something in the bulk, delta phi, right? And then you have the boundary term. Right? So now we have a solution. If you plug the solution into the action, the bulk part will be zero because this is a solution of the bulk equations. So there will be only boundary term left. Okay? And the boundary term I obtain by integration by parts. So basically I have to shift one of the derivatives from db phi, let's say I'm shifting on the other thing. But if I integrate by parts, it's like just I integrated once and there won't be any derivative, right? So just integration by parts. So the s on the bulk. And so it's when you integrate by parts, you pick up a minus sign. So it's minus c over 2 ddx square root of g. I'll just write it what it is. And then you can scream at me. Phi z x dz phi z x, and then we have two boundaries, z equal to epsilon and z equal to infinity. Okay, so what we have done, so this is precisely the boundary term which you get by integration by parts, but I integrate it in several directions, right? So I can integrate with respect to z, and this is what's written over here, right? Or I can integrate with respect to x. So now if you integrate with respect to x, what you assume is that your field decays sufficiently fast in the x direction. So if you are very, very far away in the spatial direction, the field vanishes and there's no boundary term. Okay, so this assumes that support of phi is limited in x directions, and so that's why you don't have these x terms there. And so you will have only the z term, right? And so if I really integrate by part, I just basically kill one of the derivatives acting on phi. Is this clear? You can do it yourself, okay? Just please integrate it by parts, that direction, and this is what you get, right? Very good. But now look at this thing here, right? So this is my solution. And I chose the solution k nu, right? I'm not choosing the solution which blows up at Mondo Poincaré horizon. I'm choosing the solution which is very non-trivial, close to the boundary, but on the Poincaré horizon, it vanishes, right? So you can equally actually kill this guy because this doesn't contribute because your solution actually vanishes there sufficiently fast. Okay, so really what you need to do is that you need to evaluate these guys at z equal to epsilon. And that's what supposedly gives me s of phi 0 when I plug in this solution. So this is my phi 0. I plug this solution there, put it here, calculate what gzz is, calculate what the determinant in my Poincaré coordinates is. And that's how you get this s of phi 0. So now, do I have some details anyway here? I don't want to spend time on this. So this thing here, if you use the Poincaré coordinates, you'll find that these things here are L to Z D minus 1. Okay, and so that's fine. So you can take that out of the integral. And the integral is over ddx over here. But we express this phi z x as a Fourier transformation. Okay, so for this phi z x, what we really have is phi z k. Okay, so you need to, for phi z x, you need to plug the Fourier transform, and this is your solution in the k space. But that's your solution in the x space, and you have to plug it back. Okay, so now plug here. So the solution which we have, and then here as well. And you see that the solution will have the k in it, but there's also this term which has the derivative with respect to z. So there will be also a derivative of k. Okay. So now a typical thing, right? So you plug the solution in terms of the Fourier transformation. So you have one integral dk for this guy. And then you have another integral for this guy, which will be integral over dq. So they are two different k and q, right? But I have an integral over x. And the only dependence on x will be through this e to ikx. So I will have ikx times e to iqx. Right. And so if you integrate over x, that's what gives you delta function k plus q, as you have done many times. OK, so I'll just write down the result. And you can fill in all the steps if you want. So this is equal to minus c l d minus 1 2. Now I'm evaluating this at z equal to epsilon. So it will be epsilon d minus 1. And now I kill the integration over x. But I have ddk from one Fourier transform. And then I'll have ddq from the other Fourier transform. And then I have 2 pi to power d delta k plus q. That's from the integral over x. Okay, and then you have phi zk. And then dz phi zq. So that's evaluated at z equal to epsilon. Okay, so that's what the function is. So what you have done, really, and so now you plug those things there. So we'll have, so this thing gives you k, and this thing gives you k prime, right? Okay. So there is one last step. So now what you want to do with this action, right? So in principle, you can just plug it everything in. You write it in terms of phi 0k and phi 0q, right? And then you can start calculating the correlation functions if you want. So specifically, let me consider. Let's do two-point function, OK? Two-point function. Oh, no. And I'll just write down one relation, which is sort of obvious, but again, so you have ddx. It's just a property of Fourier transformation. Ox phi 0x. So this is the source term which we are when we have it in the x space. But if you write it in the k space, it is ddk 2 pi k ok phi 0 minus k. Okay? So just prove it if you... Some equality. What is it called? Mathematicians. Percival? Percival equality or something like that, maybe. The norm in the X space is the same as the norm in the K space or something like that. OK. So anyway, so what it means is that if I write this in terms of the K in the of the Fourier space, phi 0k and phi 0q, right? So the difference is that here is plus x, but there is a minus k. OK, so if I want to calculate OK OQ in the Fourier space, two-point function in the Fourier space, I just differentiate my action with respect to phi 0 minus k and phi 0 minus q. Okay? So it will be, and there's this 2 pi to power d here. So minus 2 pi 2d, it's a property of the Fourier transform, ds square s of phi 0 is respect to d phi minus k d 0 d phi 0 minus q. Okay? So that's how you do it. And if you calculate it, okay, so you have this thing here, you plug it there, depends on phi 0, you differentiate with respect to psi 0, differentiate with respect to phi 0. This whole thing is quadratic in phi 0 because each phi has one phi 0 in it, so you get rid of both of them. And so you are just left this, and there's many, many steps in between this. You get something, and that is d over 2 plus epsilon k nu prime z of k divided by k nu epsilon k, and there's a delta k plus q. Okay, and then there's some factors which are not interesting. what is interesting is this thing here. It's an epsilon to 2 delta minus t. Okay? So this is the result. And you just all plug it there and you get it. Okay? So very good. Now what you really want to do is that you want to take the limit epsilon goes to 0. You want to shift it all the way to the boundary. Right? So this is what you are doing, you're shifting to the boundary. And so for that, what am I doing here? So z is epsilon, sorry. So z is epsilon over there, right? So I need to find the expansion of these k nu functions for small epsilon, right? So what you need to do is that you need to do Taylor expansion of k nu around epsilon equals to 0, right? And so this depends on what the nu is. So let's assume, so just, you know, assume nu is positive integer, just for simplicity. And once you do that, you find that, OK, OQ is equal to, and now look at this thing here. So delta k plus q. And you are expanding around epsilon equal to 0. So you put both all these epsilons here. And you find that there's something epsilon 2 delta minus d plus something epsilon 2 delta minus d minus 2 and so on. Okay. Plus logarithm of epsilon times something, and then plus k to 2 nu logarithm of k plus O epsilon square terms. Okay, so this is how the expansion around small epsilon looks like. And very good. So we want to calculate a two-point function. This seems like it crazy blows up. Right? If I'm sending epsilon to 0, this blows up, this blows up, this blows up, right? Disaster. However, of course, as always in quantum field theory calculation, you just disregard everything that blows up, and you just take the finite value from here. And you are right to do so. So if you kill this term, kill that term, kill that term, kill this term, this is 0, that's fine. So my result is this one. Okay? So that's your result for the two-point function. And so this is the result. And the statement is, well, this is the result in the k space. But if you go and take this result, and it is some calculation, which would be the whole tutorial, but it's ugly, technical, not learning anything calculation. So what you would find that if you return back to the, if you undo the Fourier transform, you find that this is actually gives you x minus y to 2 delta. Okay, so that's just to demonstrate how you would get in principle how you could do the two-point function calculation, and that really it gives you something which you expect from the CFT side, right? So now why? Okay, very good. So that's it's just taking this term over here. Okay. So neglecting these terms is fine, right? They just vanish. It's okay. What about these terms? What do you think? Can I? Am I really right to kill them? Okay, so this is precisely where your homeworks come in. Okay, comes in. And so you will show in your homework that, of course, the action is infinite, as always, right? But you will learn in your homework how to renormalize the action. And so you renormalize the action by adding certain boundary terms to the action. So really, the action which I was writing here is you know, it's a good action to derive equations of motion, but it's not a good action to calculate the value of the action. You need to supply boundary terms, and once you have the boundary terms, that will give you a finite action, right? You will learn in your homework that you know what these boundary terms have to be, and the statement is, this is killed by boundary terms, by counter terms, which are the boundary terms which you find in your homework. Okay, if you want, you can redo this calculation in your homework by adding these boundary terms. And in principle, it should kill all these unwanted terms, all these blowing up terms. And after that, after you put these counter terms in the action from the very beginning, you just find this term over here. Okay, disaster. Okay, questions? So okay, so we calculate a two-point function, then you can go to other point functions if you want. But it's a little bit more complicated. And if you are interested, there's this big book on IDEA CFT, and they try to calculate some other functions. But the problem is that now you have to consider interactions of the fields in the bulk as well. And it's a little bit more complicated than this, okay? But anyway, so this is how you calculate things. So we can claim victory. IDEA CFT give us a two-point function, which you can derive on the CFT side in one line, but you know, doing this horrible calculation here, we recovered it. So it's amazing, isn't it? All right. So now I needed 40 minutes for the second topic. I have something like 25. So let's just go ahead. Wilson loops. Well, this is a nice topic. So what is a Wilson loop? So Wilson loops, these are non-local gauge invariant operators, that describe parallel transport of quark along closed loop. Okay, so how is this defined? So you have probably seen it. So it depends on this closed loop. So your quark makes some crazy loop. And this is the crazy loop C here. And it's given by 1 over nc. Now trace is if you have non-abelian gauge theory, you have the path ordering, if you want, not important for us, exponential of I a mu dx mu. Okay, So this is what a Wilson loop is. And so basically what it is that you have this circular integral of the vector potential A. Right, why is this gauge invariant? Of course, this is like integral over the boundary of A, which is of dA over the interior of that circle, right? But dA is F, right? So this will only depend on F, so it will be gauge invariant, okay? So this thing is gauge invariant. And the statement is this is a nice thing to think about. So let me consider, in particular, a very specific loop here. And the loop will look like this. So it's specifically consider the following loop, which is something like this, a rectangle. This is the time direction. Let's say the size of this rectangle in the time direction is t. And the size in the space direction is r, okay? And it's a loop, so it goes like this. And then you have something strange here. So you have something which propagates forward in time over here. So that will correspond to your quark. And then I have something which propagates backward in time. So that will be the antiquark, okay? And so what this diagram really displays is, well, at some time t1, okay, t1, of course, we will send it to minus infinity eventually. But anyway, so at t1, you create a pair of quark and antiquark. You separate them distance r from each other, okay? And then these quarks and antiquarks, they just propagate in time. They don't move, so they stay static for very, very long time t. Okay, and then at some t2, which we will send to plus infinity in the end, these quarks again annihilate. And then, okay, so this is like a pair creation and annihilation. Okay, so that's a specific contour C, which looks like this rectangle and really corresponds to two static quarks which you create at some point, take them apart, they just are there, and then you annihilate them at some later time. Yes?
What's on the like space line thing?
So this thing here?
Yeah.
It's just the distance between the two quarks. So it's like you have time here, you have space here. Let's say I create the two quarks, I put them distance r.
Is it kind of like instantaneous that they just like annihilate or something? That they just, like, when they're away, they can just instantaneously like, at the same time?
That's my approximation, right?
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Would it be like, would like a more accurate picture if it wasn't like a rectangle?
Yeah, if you want, you can smooth it out, right? Okay. Yeah. Okay, yes, of course. Right? Very good. So now the question is, if I calculate this WC over this particular thing, what does it give me? Okay? And the statement is, well, okay, so if I take the expectation of this WC for this thing here, what does it give me? Right? And if you look at this thing here, well, what is this? So it's A0 dt, and then it's AI dxi. Right? So now let's say I don't have any. So the quarks, when I separate them, they are static. So there won't be any magnetic fields. The quarks are just, you know, stand there. Right? So AI is zero. So I'll just have A0 dt. Right? So it's reasonable to expect. So now what you do is that you go from t to i tau. So again, you go to the Euclidean time. So there'll be I and I, so there'll be minus. Okay, and then nothing is really happening, so that would be A0 times the full Euclidean time tau, which is the t here. So this is already a Euclidean picture. Okay. So what I'm trying to say is that this thing here is very, very reasonable to expect that this will go like e to minus t v of r, where this is something like a0. Right? So this is what it is. And then the v0, a0 is v is the potential between the two quarks, is the electrostatic potential between them, if you want. Right? So this is very reasonable to expect. Okay, so that's great. So now for quarks, this V of R have two different phases. In one case, it is proportional to R. Okay, this is in the confined phase. So you have the confined phase where the potential between the two quarks actually grows with the radius, with the separation between them. Or it goes like Coulomb's law. 1 over r, this is in the unconfined phase. OK, so that's the wisdom from the field theory.
Wait.
Yeah?
Sorry, I don't understand the picture. OK, so the expectation value. What is V being approximately R correspond to in the picture versus V being approximately 1 over R correspond to in the picture?
Oh, so the R is the distance between the two quarks, right? And the statement is you have two different behavior of quarks. If they are confined, the V it goes like something like R, right? Whereas if you have different phase, they are unconfined, So then they just, the force between them decays like the Coulomb law. Right? So that.
V in the picture.
How do you see the V in the picture? Well, you know that your Wilson loop is given something like A mu dx mu. So now A mu has A0, which you call V. Dt sort of, and then you have ai dxi, right? So now this guy is zero because the quarks are static. There's no magnetic fields. There's just electric field, if you want, very naively. And the potential does not depend on time because they just stand there, right? So this is time independent. So this gives you something like vt.
Oh.
Yes?
If you had to do the
So this is done in Euclidean. Yeah, yeah.
Why?
It's just I have the minus t instead of I there.
Wait, so okay. I think my question is more like in that picture specifically, when you have one quark moving up and the quark also moving up, like there's something or other like that. How do you show that they're confined? Like in that picture, are they confined?
Very good. So no, I'm not showing that, right? So this is the wisdom. Like you have two possible behavior of V, right? So that's something which people know, is that if you have confined quarks, the potential between them behaves certain way. There's a phase transition between the two behavior, right? In one case, they behave this way if they are confined together to form hadrons and stuff like that. Or if they are unconfined, they behave differently, right? So I am not telling you how this comes from the picture, right? It doesn't come from the picture.
Okay.
I'm just telling you that's the result. That's what's happening with quarks.
Usually, like in the middle, you can say okay, they're. I don't know. Don't they have asymptotic freedom when they're like close together or something, or they break apart and then they.
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
I don't understand the picture and why it's important.
Why the picture is important?
Yeah.
Oh, picture is just describing two quarks standing next to each other, right? That's the picture, what's telling me the picture. Okay, we can discuss later, right? We can discuss later. So now what is very important here, which I haven't stressed so far, is that typically quarks are massive objects. So here the quarks is massive, but it is also in the fundamental representation of SUNC, and it is in fundamental representation of SUNC. So when we discuss the super Young Mill so far, everything was massless. It was a conformal field theory. Then cannot be any mass, right? For conformal field theory, if you have mass, you don't have conformal invariance, right? So far our super Young Mills was massless particles, but also they were in the adjoint representation of SUNC. What is the difference? Adjoint representation is matrices, right? So compare the adjoint representation is massless, and we have matrices, if you want, like that. The fundamental representation, we have vectors. Okay, so fundamental representation, we have a vector which has nc entries. In adjoint representation, we have a matrix which has nc times nc things. Okay, so then the question is, can we get an ADS CFT picture for calculation of these Wilson loops, right? So how to get? So what is the ADS prescription for this? And in particular, we need massive quarks. And we need the fundamental representation instead of the adjoint. So remember, when we were motivating the ADS CFT, we said, OK, so I have these brains, right? And if the brains are separated away, if there's a non-trivial distance between them, my particles on the brains will be massive. If I put them together, they will be massless. OK, so in the standard picture, you have these NC brains like that. They are all stuck together. So there's NC brains. And if you have something which goes like this, right, then it will be massless. Okay. But at the same time, I can start. I have NC starting points. And I have sort of NC ending points. I can go from this brain to second one, to third one, to fourth one. But I can also start in the second brain, go to the first one, to the third one, and so on. We have NC square possibilities, right? So this is precisely why you have a joint representation. You have matrix NC times NC. OK, so we have massless. So this corresponds to a joint representation. Now, can you see how to do massive and fundamental representation? Any proposals? Exactly. And how far is the brain from the other brains? And if I want really, really massive object, it will be very, very far away. So now what you do is that you add one more brain here. Okay. So now I'm adding. So I have now NC plus one brains. So this is a additional brain. Now, if I stretch a string here, coming from this brain to the stack of NC brains, then the distance between these things here, so the distance between them is proportional to the mass. And you know, if I put this brain very, very far away, it will be huge. Okay, so if I want very, very massive object, I just take this one brain and put it to infinity. Okay. But at the same time, now the string, well, it has to end here on that brain. But now how many possibilities it has to end here? NC. So now additional brain, now this can end on the stack in NC ways. And so really, this will correspond to the fundamental representation. There's only nc entries in the thing here. Okay, so very good. So now this is very good. So this thing here, this point thing here will be my quark. Okay, living on the brain. Now I want my quark to live on the boundary of the ADS. So what I do is that I place this thing here on the boundary of ADS. So this will be on D of ADS. Okay. So this single out brain, I'll just put at infinity. And then I do whatever I have been doing with the stack of NC brains, right? What we were doing with the stack of the NC brains. We said, well, very good. So this is my open string prescription, but I can go to the closed string prescription. And I found that this is just a massive black brain, and I can go to near horizon limit, and I get ADS 5 crosses 5. Okay, so the prescription now here is you just take these NC brains and you replace them with ADS 5 crosses 5. Okay, so the prescription is as follows. So you have this single out brain here. Now, what you want to study is some closed loop on that brain. So that's what the quark is doing, right? So this is the closed loop C for the quark. Okay. Then I have these NC coalescent brains, which I replace with ADS 5 cross S5. Okay. And then, you know, the string goes from here. So that's my quark. Okay. But I also need my antiquark. So what I do is that I extend this string here, sort of goes to these brains, but these brains are no longer there. It's just ADS5 cross S5. So I turn it around and end it here. And that's my antiquark. Okay.
Turn around in ADS5
process. Oh, it's just, you know, you extend the string from your boundary. So one endpoint is fixed here on the boundary, and the other endpoint of the string is also fixed on the boundary. But you know, that was for one instant of time. But later on, you know, so let's say this is the time direction. I will have another string. Oh, this will be a horrible picture. Horrible. Like that, and so on. So in the end, you know, this thing here sweeps some surface sigma in ADS5 crosses 5. So the worksheet of this, you know, string, which extends to the boundary. So this is the worksheet. World sheet of string. And so what you require is that the boundary of this worksheet precisely gives you your circle C. Okay, so what you require that sigma on the boundary is equal to C.
Sorry, if you have these strings or the world sheet, you know, going out and back to the same sheet, wouldn't the quarks be massless?
No, because it really corresponds to this thing here. So really, you know, you can think about it that the ADS5 cross S5 really represents the brains, and it sort of goes all the way to the brains, right? So it's this distance is important, sort of.
Okay.
Yeah. Well. Yeah, you have a point, sort of. But okay. So this is the prescription. Very good. But now, of course, what you do is that you say, well, I, again, as always, I go lambda goes to infinity and C goes to infinity. So in that case, everything in ADS5 crosses 5 has to be classical. So what you really have is classical strings in ADS5 crosses 5. And we know that the classical strings are described by the Nambu-Goto action. Right? So what you really are seeking is, you know, the classical motion of the string. Well, what is the classical So you hang the string from your boundary, but the string has to satisfy classical equations of motion coming from the Nambu-Goto action. Okay, and so we have a prescription is that this expectation value V of C is just given by E to classical action, which is the Nambu-Goto action. But we know that it has to be, you know, evaluated on classical solution, so it's the extremal of this Nambu-Goto action, right? Well, the S Nambu-Goto action is just 1 over 2 pi alpha prime d square of sigma square root of determinant of the induced metric on the thing where you require that really it ends on where you require this, that that the string ends on your circle which you prescribe. Okay, and so that's the prescription. How you calculate the expectation value of your Wilson loop is just given in the leaning order by just a classical Nambu-Goto action for the string, such that the endpoints actually move on that circle C. Yes?
I'm not able to get this picture yet. Usually, open, like excitations of open strings are bosonic fields, and that's why when an open string from one plane to another, on that stack of plane, you think of it as a gauge field in a conformal field theory. But I don't know how to think of
like. So you are going beyond, you know, the. You don't have quarks in super young males, right? So you don't have massive objects in super young males. So you're basically perturbing your super young males by something, and so you know, if you don't believe in this motivation, that's fine, right? So the important thing is, like, people postulated that this is true. You can motivate it sort of by these pictures, by drawing these pictures. But, you know, the question is, if you assume that this is true, you do calculations, does it give you the right result? Okay? And so that's the key point. But of course, it's important to realize that the quarks are not described by super young males, right? They are massive objects. They are not CFT. You are going beyond that. And okay. So now I have 5 minutes, so let me just do something. So you will have a nice tutorial on this where you will calculate the one of these potentials. I think it's the, which one? Probably the 1 over r potential. Doing this exactly, calculating what the Nambu-Goto action is, finding what really is the optimal shape which extremizes your Nambu-Goto action for the string and stuff like that. But let me just cheat and give you the answer, which is almost correct, without doing any calculation, sort of. So let's just do the qualitative estimate. So qualitative estimate. And what we want is the unconfined phase. So let me just draw a few pictures. So this is my boundary, z equal to 0. I have one quark here. I have the antiquark here. This is at, you know, given time. Given time. And you know, the string extends like this into the bulk. So this is the z. So there's a bulk here. Here. And that's at a given instant of time. And then, if I want my time evolution, the quarks will move, let's say, in this, you know, time direction through the blackboard. And so they will form this tunnel. Right, they have the like tunnel going like that, right? So at a later time, you know, this thing here will move there, and that thing will move there, and so this is at a given instant of time, right? And so the separation between the two quarks is r, okay? So that's the thing, and so of course you find the shape. So this shape is given by extremizing. Nambu-Goto action, right? You need to find the axiom of the Nambu-Goto action, which gives you how the string looks like, and then stuff like that. Okay, so let me cheat, and let's say well, whatever the shape is, this thing here, I can approximate it with a rectangle. Why not? Okay. So this thing here approximately looks like this thing here, Q, QR. This is the distance between the two. Is that equal to zero? Okay. So now, if I approximate it as a rectangle, how far do I need to go to the bulk? That's the question, right? So you have these things here, and then you have this thing here. So this is still R, right? This thing here is still R. How far do I need to go in the bulk? Well, if I make this distance bigger, do you expect that this goes deeper in the bulk, or does it go more shallow to the bulk? Goes
more shallow.
Really? So remember, we are using the Poincaré coordinates, right? And the Poincaré coordinates, they have dz square, but also they have dx square, dy square. So the x and z, they enter the same footing. So this thing here goes as deep as z0, which is proportional to r. So you know, whatever happens in the x direction has to happen in the z direction as well. Okay, very good. So now your induced metric in Poincaré coordinates is just this thing here. Now we vic rotate the time, so it's d tau square, and then you have dx square for this piece here. So by the way, this is this piece here which is interesting, which describes your VR. This thing here describes just, you know, self-energy or of the two quarks. Or if you want, like the zero mass of the two quarks, right? So you can show that this thing here is not interesting. So I'm interested in this piece here, and in that case, my induced metric is this thing here. Okay. So now, what the determinant of gamma AB? That gamma AB is. Is that 2x2 matrix? So it's L square over z square, but I evaluate z at z zero, so z zero square. Okay, so that's what the determinant of the metric is, and then if I calculate what the S Nambu-Goto is, well, this is 1/(α′) this thing here, determinant of gamma AB L square over z zero square. That zero square integral d tau dx. Dx is r. So this is 1/(α′) L square z zero square. Dx is r. It's just this piece over here. D tau is t. Okay. And z zero is proportional to r. So this will be r square. Okay, what is alpha prime? It's ls square. This guy is ls square. So you have that it's l square over ls square t over r. L square over ls square, if you remember your dictionary for ADS CFT, is square root of 2 lambda. Okay, so this thing here is square root of 2 lambda. Well, lambda is your Toft coupling, right? And so now this is your S Nambu-Goto. But if you look at this prescription here, S Nambu-Goto precisely corresponds to minus T times V. Right? So this must be T times V. And so you find that the V here goes like square root of 2 lambda divided by R. Okay, so you just discovered this unconfined potential, which goes like 1/(r). So you just discovered the Coulomb's law between the two quarks. Isn't this amazing? So you will do this calculation exactly, calculating exactly what the corresponding shape has to be, not using this approximation, but you should find something like this. One warning, if you do the weak field perturbation theory, what you find is proportional to λ/r. Here, you have strongly coupled field theory, find its square root of lambda divided by r. So that's so this thing here is the strong field effect. Strong coupling effect. Okay, let me stop here. Questions? So yes, you can use string theory to calculate the column's potential. Okay, I think, please go ahead. Thank you.